The Teaching Saints Virtual Summit was an incredible success. We had thousands of individuals tune in from around the world to hear from people like Brad Wilcox, Hank Smith, Casey Griffiths, Marie Eckersley, Jason Hewlett, Jeff Burke, and more as they taught us about how to better stimulate classroom discussion, create effective classroom environments, best practices with object lessons, and so much more. If you missed the summit, be sure to visit leadinglds.org/teach to watch the three most viewed sessions from the online conference. It will not only change you, but it will change those you teach. Check out the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit today. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org.
Hello, this is Kurt Frankum with the Leading LDS Podcast. I will be your host, just like I have been your host in the 270 plus episodes that are on the Leading LDS Podcast. I'm happy to be back. Now, each episode has that intro about what Leading LDS, we're a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing the ability and capacity of lay leaders within the church. I hope that makes sense. At the end of the day, this is a nonprofit organization, a community of lay leaders within the LDS Church where we've gotten together, putting some content out there, and we just want you to feel like you're a prepared leader. That you can walk into any situation, not necessarily having all the answers, but that you're ready. You're ready to face it, and you have some resources to draw upon to really hit maybe not a home run every time, but maybe a double or a triple, or just get on base sometimes. That's what all we're asking. So I welcome you to the Leading LDS Podcast. If you're new, I encourage you to go over to leadinglds.org and check us out. This is another example of the fantastic quality that we try and produce at Leading LDS. It's not because of anything great we do, but we find some pretty awesome people to interview and talk to. And we're bringing back a guest that's been on the podcast before, Whitney Johnson, who back in, I think it was published on February of 2018, we did another interview with her called Disrupt Your Calling. And in that interview, we talked about this upcoming book she had coming out, and it's now released. The book is called Build an A-Team, Play to Their Strengths, and Lead Them Up the Learning Curve. So this is a fantastic resource for you as a leader who's trying to have influence on building a team, whether it's a presidency, a quorum, a relief society. This is a fantastic resource. I'm in the middle of the book, getting through it and loving every chapter. One I can't recommend enough. And so it's just brand new out. You can find it on Amazon. Definitely pick it up. But in this interview, we talk about some very interesting concepts, everything from engagement. How do we know when those in our quorum or those that we're leading are just disengaged, or are they lazy? Are they just not being fulfilled, or do they not want to be fulfilled? And how do you move forward as a leader to inspire them and engage them in the work we're doing? And is there a fatigue that happens? And how do we approach that when it comes to leading within the church? She has a fantastic concept about S-curves and how we can spot when we're developing as leaders, when others are developing, and how we need to do that over and over again. But I don't want to summarize the whole thing, because really, let's just get into this, and you can benefit from the fantastic research and genius of Whitney Johnson. So here is my interview with Whitney Johnson, the author of Build an A-Team, Play to Their Strengths, and Lead Them Up the Learning Curve.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS community, Whitney Johnson. How are you, Whitney?
I'm fine, thank you, Kurt.
Now, it was a few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, that we had you on the Leading LDS podcast, and we actually got to record that in person, which is always a little more fun, but we can't do that every time, right?
Right. No, we can't.
No, but we're going to, the information and content is what's important. And I got to tell you, my sister, she lives in serves in a primary presidency, and she recommended Leading LDS to her primary president. I don't know if she specifically mentioned yours up front, but this primary president went and I think the first interview she found was with you, and she came back to my sister and she said, I have listened to the Whitney Johnson interview three times in a row. So you're definitely making impact in the community.
Oh, I'm so glad that it's helpful.
So, and now you have a new book that just came out.
Right. Yes, May 1st, May Day.
Wow. And now you're in the thick of the book launch, right? Interviews. How many, dozens of interviews a day that you're trying to get ahead of things?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say dozens, but like four or five a day. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Nice.
It's fun. It's really fun.
I bet. Anything new in your life that to bring us up to speed? We talked a little bit about your story.
Anything new in my life? So just a quick update there. Our son just finished his first year at Utah State, and this is a shout out for missions, right? Because in high school, I think I talked about this before, in high school, he was like, yeah. And he goes on a mission. And we always heard missions, the miracle is the missionary, but our family, absolutely, because his work ethic kind of went from here to here. And so he's just finished up his first year at Utah State and has close to straight A's, if not straight A's. Yeah. And so then, and we're out here in Virginia. My husband teaches at Southern Virginia University and he loves it. So shout out, plug for Southern Virginia University if you're looking for an LDS oriented experience, but at a really small school. So, and then my daughter, I don't want to ignore my daughter. She's a junior in high school taking AP tests right now.
Nice. And just looking forward to the next school dance, right?
No, she's not into that.
Well,
she's not into that.
So, their own.
Exactly.
Not that. AP classes are not a bad way to go. So
exactly. Cool. AP cool. Chemistry. Yeah.
Awesome. So let's jump in and talk about your book a little bit. So was this Building A-Team, was that a natural step from your first book, Disrupt Yourself?
Yeah, it was. Surprisingly so. So I wrote Disrupt Yourself, and obviously we'll want people to go back and listen to that first podcast. But yeah. The idea of Disrupt Yourself is, how do you know when it's time to make a change? I was leveraging the framework of disruption that I had learned working with Clayton Christensen and having co-founded an investment firm with him. And then coming up with these seven steps of personal disruption, this framework that you follow. One of the things that happened is I was out talking to people and saying, okay, here's how you know when it's time to make a change. Here's a framework to do it. This is what it looks like. People would say to me, okay, I got it. But how do I get my boss to let me disrupt myself? And how do I create an ecosystem where disruption was possible? And so this book, whereas Disrupt Yourself is for you, this book, Build an A-Team, is for you as a manager or as a leader.
Gotcha. Yeah. And really, would you categorize it that you're trying to disrupt your team or disrupt your organization through the team?
Yeah, exactly. So my thesis is that it's not companies or organizations that disrupt, it's the people who do.
Yeah.
And when you're willing to allow a person to learn, leap, and repeat, so be at the bottom of a learning curve, climb to the top of the curve, then jump to the bottom of a new learning curve, every time they do that, they're putting themselves in a position where they're learning something new. And when you're learning something new, you tend to be somewhat innovative because you're playing where you haven't played before. And so as people are trying to figure out places for themselves to play, they by default figure out somewhere new for the organization to play. And so that's how you're able to drive the disruption, the innovation as an organization via the people.
And this may be a tangent a little bit, but my mind goes to, like, sometimes I see individuals, especially you see like protesters with the church or individuals interrupting meetings in the church. They're trying to bait a larger organization into creating change, when sometimes I feel like leading LDS, we're not protesting out the conference center saying we need better leadership, but we're jumping in and saying, well, maybe if we come together, we can figure out things that work. And over time that may change the culture, and rather than just petitioning to this large organization about change.
It's a really interesting observation. I think that, you know, I do think that gadflies do play a role. They get people's attention. At the same time, what I would say is that, thinking about this in the parlance of the learning curve, is that every single person is on a learning curve, including you and me. And whenever you're trying to effect change, you are in effect saying to the people, I want you to jump to a new learning curve. And that new learning curve is not your learning curve. It's actually, at least right now, it looks like it's my learning curve. And so you've got to find a way to basically pack a parachute for people to change. And so when you've got people who are protesting in these big meetings, they're basically saying, jump to my curve. It's my curve. It's awesome because it's my curve. Mm-hmm. I'm packing absolutely no parachute to do it. And I would say to you, something like Leading LDS Podcast, you're saying, we want change. We're trying to figure out what that looks like, whatever the change needs to look like. And so we're going to build a case. We're going to pack a parachute with data and experts and make it safe for you to try something new.
Yeah. And I feel like that approach, has a greater chance of working because it's a little more diplomatic, right? It's, you're not insulting everybody or saying you're wrong and just do what I'm doing because I'm right. And I just know I'm
right. Right. Well, and not only is it more diplomatic, but the research shows Dr. Judith Glaser, she studies neuroscience and psychology. Her research shows that we're all addicted to being right. We're all addicted to being right. And the reality is that even the prophets probably a little bit addicted to being right, probably less than most, probably less than anybody else on the earth. But whenever you have this idea of like, whenever I have an idea, because it's mine, I think it's brilliant. And it's the same with you. Mm-hmm. You have an idea because it's your, you think it's brilliant. And so when we're willing to do these things gently and build a case, we're making it safer for the other person. And we're in fact saying, you know what, this is my idea, but I think it's so good, I'm going to share it with you. Mm. And by sharing it with you, it becomes your idea. And as it becomes your idea, then it becomes your learning curve. And it makes it easier for you to jump to that curve because now it's not just mine, it's also yours.
Yeah. And I would imagine in the secular context, like being the manager, being the boss, not only are you addicted to being right because it's human nature, but you sort of bring this authority with it too, right? That especially in the church context, you know, comparing it to that, that this is very difficult, I know, from being a bishop to struggle with, because not only am I addicted to being right, do I feel like I've got the best answers, but I also have priesthood keys. And there may be some inspiration mixed in with this that you need to listen to my ideas a little bit more because I have these keys, but that can shortchange you as a leader too because you're not getting all the ideas out.
Absolutely. I think it's very powerful. And yet what I would say is as a church leader, then there's also this element of if you're really using your keys properly, there's also this tremendous measure of humility.
Yeah.
And there's also a willingness to say, here's the revelation that I have and the inspiration I have, but I also believe in a church where you, the person I'm extending a calling to, for example, is entitled to your own revelation. So I've prayed about this and this is how I feel about it. I need you, because when you're saying, let's do X, Y, or Z, you have stewardship, but they also have stewardship over their own lives. So if you're willing to exercise the humility that any priesthood leader would do, if you're really trying to magnify your calling, you're also going to say to the person, will you please pray about it as well? Can you get your inspiration? And then let's see where this takes us. And that to me is when there are moments of magnificence in terms of being able to feel the Spirit and really feel, for example, that you've been extended a calling by God when you're both having that experience of revelation.
Mm, I love that. Love that. And maybe break down, because I know that this S-curve idea is really the crux of a large part of the book. So explain what does this S-curve mean and how is it applicable to our leadership situations?
So one of the big insights that I had when I was investing with Clayton Christensen was that the S-curve, it was popularized by E.M. Rogers in 1962 to help explain how quickly an innovation would be adopted. And so if you think about an S, I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like. At the beginning or the low end of the S, growth is really, really slow. It feels like not much is happening. But then you hit the knee of an S. And that is, well, actually, I'll finish from an investing standpoint. You hit the knee of the S, typically 10 to 15% penetration of any given market opportunity. And then at 90% or saturation, growth tapers off. Now the aha, and here's what we're talking about today, is that this also applies to learning. So whenever you start something new, you start a new job, you start a new role, you start a new calling, for the first little while, it can be 3 months, 6 months, maybe a year, but usually about 6 months, you're at the low end of the S. So you're going to come home from church every week and go, I have no idea what I'm doing in this calling. I'm kind of discouraged. Why did God call me to do this? And it just doesn't make sense. And I'm frustrated. Well, that's because you're at the low end of the learning curve. You're inexperienced. You don't quite know what you're doing. Now, that's the downside. The upside is that because you're at the low end of that learning curve, you're also asking lots of questions like, why do we do it like this? Probably you remember when you were a new bishop, you're like, why do we do it? Well, huh, why do we do it like that? And so on good days for everybody around you, it's pesky like a three-year-old. And on bad days, you feel threatened. The people who you're asking it to feel threatened because you're basically saying, why do you do it like this? And you're asking questions. But that's what the low end of the curve looks like. New calling, new job, new role. Then after you put in some time, you go to the knee of the curve and it's the steep part of the curve, that back of the S. Mm-hmm. And this is the sweet spot where you're engaged. You know enough, but not too much. And you're typically there for somewhere between a year to 3 years. And that's the part where you've really got it down. You feel like you know what you're doing in your calling. I'm sure, you know, if you think about it, bishops tend to be bishops for 4 to 5 years. You mentioned being a bishop, so I think this is relevant. Mm-hmm. So the first 6 months to a year, you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. Then you hit year one, probably year two, three, four. You're like, okay, I got this. Like, I got it. I still don't know what I'm doing exactly, but I got it in enough that I feel like I've got it in hand. And so that's because you're learning. It's fun. You feel competent. You feel confident. That's the sweet spot of the curve. And then you get to the top of the curve and it flattens off. And that's the part where you start to be a master. And really what's happening is that because you pretty much know what you're doing, your brain gets bored. And because your brain gets bored, you're no longer enjoying that dopamine hit of learning new things. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. You know exactly where all the pieces are going to fit. And on the one hand, you'd say, great, he knows, she knows exactly what you're doing. But on the other hand, it's actually the danger zone because you're going to get bored. And when you get bored, you get complacent. And when you get complacent, you're actually not working very hard. And so what's interesting to me about this is that in the workplace, there's all sorts of mechanisms to try to keep people there forever and ever and ever, and nothing happens. And then so people leave or they get bored and they dial it in. But in the church, the beauty of the gospel is you get to the top of the learning curve and what happens?
You get released.
You get released.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So basically what we're saying is this cycle of learn and then you leap and you repeat. It's what we do in the church. And it's one of the reasons why I believe that the church is so innovative is because you have people going into all these different places where they have no idea what they're doing, but because they love the gospel, because of revelation, and because they're willing to work hard, they figure it out and they get to the top. And they've really figured it out, and then they start all over again. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And I've often had this thought, because it goes back to this S curve. Again, the point isn't to get everybody at the top of the S curve and keep them there, but to get them to repeat the S curve again and again and again, right? And like you said, the model of the church really perpetuates this. And oftentimes in the discouraging days of leading LDS, I'm thinking, man, we're trying to put out so much content, just get it out there, but are we really having an impact? Is really anything changing? And this really helps me realize, again, it's not about getting the whole church to the top of the S-curve, but how can we help people get through that cycle again and again and again? Because that's where the true development, and most importantly, the engagement of serving the church comes from, is repeating these things over and over again.
That's right. It's the engagement over and over again. And someone who's going to listen to what you do today might not actually be relevant, but in a year, when they get a new calling, it will be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to talk about this idea of engagement. And I just got done reading some of these chapters. So I don't know if engagement is a theme throughout the book, but you talk about, and I think this comes from a Gallup research study, and I've heard it before. And this stat always just blows me away, that 33% of people, I assume this is a national survey, are engaged in their work. So, right. I mean, that is just mind blowing. But at the same time, it doesn't surprise me. And mm-hmm. So why is engagement so important, or why is this, why did you mention this statistic?
Because I mentioned the statistic because it's a really interesting question. Why did I mention that statistic? It's almost like, well, because I mentioned that statistic. It's fine. So I mentioned it because what my view is that if you are not engaged, this isn't my view, this is the data. If you're not engaged as a business, your operating margins are lower than if you are engaged as a business. So for your bottom line, if you're running any sort of business, your people being disengaged hurts your bottom line. Your ROI is lower, your stock price is lower. So then the solution is, how do you get your people to be engaged? And there are all sorts of different ways that people are approaching this. My thesis is that the way you get people engaged is you get them learning. Because when you're learning, you're engaged. You just are, because you're figuring something out. And I think, again, this goes back to the gospel, is that we're constantly learning. Like, I have a calling. I think I mentioned this before. I'm a Laurel advisor. And it's been a fascinating journey for me. In fact, just not too long ago, I was probably about 9 months in, I was like, I travel all the time. I need to get released. Like, I'm not doing a good job. And my husband, truth teller that he is, said to me, you know, you were called to this calling and you do not need to ask to be released. God and the bishop will ask you to be released when you're supposed to be released. He doesn't say it quite like that. I use that tone because he's really like the nicest person on the face of this earth. I'm using it because that's just how I talk. And so just figure out how to magnify the calling with what you have. And so some of the things I've realized is, okay, so I may travel a lot. I'm gone lots of Sundays, but what then can I do? Well, I can send the Laurels text messages. So when I'm traveling, you know, they might have a question of like, how do I know if I'm getting revelation? Is it God or is it me? And so I'll do a little bit of research and I'll send them text messages, individual text messages. So that's something I can do. I like researching stuff. I like figuring stuff out. I can send them texts. And so that's how I can magnify my calling. I'm digressing a little bit, but the point is that in your calling, you get to figure out how you do it. And that's part of being at the bottom of a curve, is that you figure out a way that Kurt would magnify it. And I figure out how to magnify a calling as a Laurel advisor the way Whitney would, not the way that my next door neighbor would, et cetera.
Yeah. And this is definitely like, when it comes to engagement, this is probably the number one concern I get from the leading LDS audience is, how do I, they don't say these words, but how do I engage my people? How do I motivate people? And don't you feel like a lot of leaders can sometimes misinterpret disengagement with laziness, assuming, oh, they're just lazy?
Yes. Yes. And, yes, and absolutely. And sometimes people are lazy. Let's be clear, you know, and we all have our moments of laziness, but I think that disengagement oftentimes is symptomatic of people are just bored out of their minds.
But never church. Come on, right?
Never, ever, ever. And so you've got to give them something that pushes. And I think what's difficult at church, I mean, this is the beauty and the challenge, right? Is I could be kind of a bad Laurel advisor because it's not like I'm not going to get paid, mm-hmm. right? You know, I could kind of just, so the motivation to figure out how to be engaged has to come a little bit more. But presumably if we really believe in revelation and that we're called to these callings by God, maybe that's a little bit helpful in getting some motivation.
Yeah. And I think there's this other dynamic, and I'm interested to hear your point of view on it, that like I was recently called as the Elders Quorum President, you know, with the change in
oh, right.
Okay. The thing. So here I am as the Elders Quorum President. I'm sort of new in this area. I've lived for about 9 months. And so I definitely don't know everybody as well as others in the quorum, but nonetheless, I'm trying to learn names, get to know people, that sort of thing. But I also want to, I sort of go in there like, all right, you know, here we go, sort of as the football coach, let's give our best in this ministering effort. But at the same time, I think, man, I look around the room and I think, that guy over there has like, he's been to like 5 dance recitals this week. He's got a son in soccer and man, he's got an incredible job. Like, I wonder if there's this level of engagement fatigue that they may have a great job that they're engaged in. Maybe their home life is great, their engagement. And then they go to church and like, okay, here's one more thing to be engaged in.
Right.
And I sort
right.
of feel like we, how do you get past that to?
It's a really interesting question, Kurt. You know, one of the things that I am noticing, and I think this is part of our growing up, is that I think when we're younger, and I think this, we can maybe potentially draw an analogy here with the learning curve, although we're riffing now, is that engagement looks different and it's not, you know, 100% all the time at any given time. I think we have ebbs and flows in our lives where, you know, there are going to be periods where you can give more. You feel it. You're able to, there's a sense in your heart and soul that you could do more. And so you do more. There are going to be times when you're really being challenged spiritually. Things are tough for you emotionally and whatever's happening works hard or you just don't know what. And so the best you can do is just hang in there. And I know I've had periods of my life where I'm really able to give at church. And there have been other periods of my life where I have just been hanging on and people have been serving me. And so I think for when it comes to the gospel, I think engagement is you're always showing up however you can, yeah. knowing that there are going to be times when you're really able to do it. And there are times when you're not, but you just keep trying. I mean, I think I love that talk by Elder Holland. I think it was 2 general conferences ago where it's be therefore perfect eventually. Mm. And I think that's the beauty of the gospel. It's eventually, it's just a matter of, do we keep showing up? And for me, the big, big, big question is how am I doing today versus a year ago? How am I doing today versus 10 years ago? And I know just the other day, I was something that I'm struggling with. I was getting kind of discouraged. I have a little bit of a negative streak in me. And I had asked for a priesthood blessing, and my husband said, Heavenly Father said, just take a moment and look at how you were 20 years ago. Like, don't you think you're doing a lot better? And I was like, yeah, I'm doing a lot better. So I think for everybody who's looking at this from an S curve, you know, you've got these little S curves that are callings. But the question is for your big S curve of your life, are you continually moving up?
Yeah.
And that to me is the question.
Yeah. I love that concept of looking, you know, admiring the big S curves for what they are and the little S curves for what they are. Right. And mm-hmm. a lot of times I see that in myself and in others, especially when I served in a state presidency and I'm, you know, mentoring these bishops and elders quorum presidents, and, you know, they just come and they get discouraged, like, ah, nothing's happening, nothing's changing. And sometimes I think, especially in the church level, you have to just step back and just say, yeah, you know, people are showing up and they're doing the best they can. And yeah, we don't have like incredible record-breaking numbers and we're not doubling the missionary baptisms, but, you know, people come on Sunday and we're doing okay, you know, and just sort of stepping back and then looking at the broader scope of what are those little S curves? How do they turn into big S curves?
Right. And I think this is where the gospel is so beautiful. I remember when we were living in New York, Richard Bushman, he was the patriarch, and he said, you know, God oftentimes talks to the church, you know, writ large, the big group of us, but when it comes to patriarchal blessing, it's always the individual. And I've never forgotten that. And I also think about that with my lawyers, my laurels. I don't know why that was maybe a good Freudian slip, but I think that if you, you know, I look at it and I say, just the other day, I had one of my laurels reach out to me and say, hey, I read this book the other day. I thought you would like it. And I'm like, yes, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Because
yeah.
What that means is she knows I care enough. She knows I care about her.
Yeah.
And so if she knows I care about her, then that's one other adult in her life that is at some level a stand-in for God, right? Because adults do that for children. Then you're making progress. And I think in our callings, these little S curves, we need to measure how we're doing, not in those big statistics, which is why I think we're going to ministering, but is one person or two people, are their lives a little bit better because of what you or I did? And then we're winning.
Yeah. And really those little S curves, like you said, they're typically individuals, right? And I think back in my time, if I look back at my time as being bishop, you know, they didn't build some monument to me. I'm not this legend that they keep talking about. Most of them probably forgot my name or moved out or whatever, but I could easily come up with a list of 10 people who really I connected with and still look to me and talk to that we made a connection and their life was changed by my service. My life was changed by theirs. And was that worth 4 or 5 years of my life? Yeah, I'd say so. You know,
that's a win. That's a big win.
Awesome. That's great. And because I think engagement, you know, going back to the broader theme here, engagement is just one that I think, especially a lot of, you know, with these new changes, they're energizing. A lot of elders quorum presidents or least study presidents are walking in there with new energy. And I'm just afraid that the appreciation of that energy will come from, why aren't they engaged? Like, why don't they care? They just seem like they're lazy, but we have to look back at the broader picture.
Yeah. And to me, I've been thinking about this. People will say to me sometimes, you know, well, we just had this, you know, inside of a business, but I think it applies to church. We just had this program and we did all this work and not much has changed. And now we've got to do it again. And my comment is, if things changed for 5 minutes, then it changed. Like, that's the whole idea of spaced repetition. That's why we go to church every Sunday. That's why we read the scriptures every day, because we have to just keep at it. And to me, I don't find it actually discouraging. I find it that we just get to play a role in a person potentially changing today. And then tomorrow it'll be someone else. And it's just very, very granular.
Yeah. Anything else around that topic of engagement that we haven't touched on?
No. I think we're good.
The other thing that stuck out as I was reading is this concept of, and you use a few examples of, you know, in the secular context of a lot of people when maybe someone quits or retires and they need new personnel, they sort of rush to hire people quicker than they look to see who they already have and who they can train and bring up in the organization. I think there's a stat, it was at 40% typically hire people. I don't know if you have that off the top of your head.
I don't remember that stat off the top of my head, but I know to what you're referring. So this idea of someone's just left and we're like, so I'll give you an example because I think this is really interesting. So the NFL, a lot of people like football, and they were hiring for a position with the VP of IT. And so this individual went online and was playing, you know, picking their fantasy football team, and they looked at it and they're like, oh, the NFL's hiring a VP of IT. I think I might apply for it. Then the person, you know, they look at it and they're like, oh, this looks really interesting. And the person's spouse looks at it and goes, that sounds just like you. And then she, Michelle McKenna Doyle, looks at it and she goes, you know, they don't need a VP of IT. They need a CIO. They need a chief information officer. So she had to basically interview for VP of IT, but she goes to Roger Goodell, who's the, you know, the NFL commissioner, and says, you don't actually need a VP of IT. What you really need is a CIO. And that's what I can do for you. And so I do think sometimes, and certainly, you know, we've got pretty clear callings and wards, but I think one of the things that's so exciting about what President Nelson has done is this exact thing of saying, this is what it looks like. And we've had elders quorum and we've had high priests, but this actually isn't what we need. What we really need is we need an elders quorum. So yeah, we're going to change that. So we're going to hire for what we need right now. And so I think that applies in the workplace. I think it applies in church, is that, you know, just because the old job description was right 10 years ago, it may not be right now. And so be willing to be a little bit flexible.
Yeah. And what can we learn from this as far as developing those that we lead? Because I often look at, you know, different studies or books that talk about, you know, getting everybody on the bus, right? Getting the right people on the bus.
Right.
And I always read that, you know, in the church context, I think that's great and all, but try and do that with a clear geographic, you know, using just one neighborhood and finding people within there. And that's sort of what we're faced with in the church, that we, you know, hiring is not an option. We can pray for a new family to come in,
but
at the end of the day, we have to work with who we've got. So what can we learn about just developing people from within?
Yeah. So what's interesting to me is there's this, a town in Butte, Montana called the Richest Hill on Earth. And it's an interesting town because in the 1800s, you had a bunch of miners go there and they were mining for gold and silver. And then they didn't find very much gold and silver. They got really discouraged. They sold off all their claims. And these next wave of miners discovered copper. And at the time, copper was like, yeah, not very valuable. But then technology advanced, electrical wiring became a thing, and then copper became extremely valuable. And so these people who were patient are now known as the Copper Kings. And I think that we do some of this in the church, is we look around and all too often we do a little bit of central casting, you know, and we all do it. Like, we know our bishop's been in for 5 years. We know the Relief Society's been in for 5 years or 3 years or whatever it is. I think it's going to be her or her or her or her or him or him or him or him or him. And we're really looking on the outside and not saying, okay, who else could it be? Like, who are the unusual suspects? Who are some people who have some skills that they're not prototypical, they're not stereotypical, but God might call them? Now, the reality is that Heavenly Father can work with a lot of different people, but I do think that we are living a little bit below our privileges because we don't necessarily pray about everybody we could be praying about with callings. And I think that's what applies here, is you hire for potential, not for proficiency. There are some stories, we've heard them at General Conference, where they've called people, you know, man's been smoking for 20 years and hasn't been paying his tithing, and now we call him and now he's the stake president. So it does happen. And so if it happens once and it happens twice, why couldn't it happen more often? And I do think too, someone like you, you've been a bishop, you've been an stake president. You know, sometimes it happens where call someone who's a little bit less experienced to be the elders quorum president and let you be his first counselor.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Exactly. And I guess, is it just a matter of just giving it a try or rolling the dice, for lack of a better term? Or is there
a way? We're not rolling the dice because we don't gamble.
Right.
Just in case you didn't know that.
Poor wording. But because not only do individuals do it like within the ward, thinking, oh, probably that guy or that guy is going to be the next bishop. But I've been in many meetings where I myself am doing that, you know, striving to receive revelation, thinking, okay, we got four guys. Okay, it's going to be one of these.
Right.
But I wonder, is there any tactic or approach that we could take to really have faith in that? Or is it just a matter of just having faith?
I think it's a matter of, number one, knowing that two things. There's definitely faith there. But I do think there's also an element of being willing to break down what needs to be done into its component pieces and saying to yourself, like, what really needs to be done here? And then looking at, you know, the people that are potential candidates, or, you know, could that person potentially do it? And at least being willing to pray about it. Again, you know, we've got we're smart people, but I think if we would just be a little bit more open, we would have a few more callings that were a little bit surprising. And the fact that we're not ever very often surprised by who gets called tells me that we could do a little bit more.
That's a good way to look at it. For a bishopric to stand back and say, are people, you know, one out of five callings, are they surprised? One out of 10, one out of 20? And
yeah, just ask her, are they ever kind of surprised?
You're right. Yeah. I think that's a great perspective. Well, as you look back, and again, I haven't had the opportunity, I'm reading it, and I've been really enjoying the book. Again, the book is Build an A-Team, Play to Their Strengths, and Lead Them Up the Learning Curve. Any other point or principle in the book that just really is applicable to the leadership and management in an award or stake?
With an award, okay. So we talked a little bit about, let's just go through it really quickly. I would say you've got people at the low end of the learning curve. When they're brand new in a calling, be willing and patient and open to their ideas and suggestions for things you might do differently. They're not going to know what they're doing. You're used to that. But also be willing to be like, okay, let's at least entertain their ideas, knowing that we're addicted to being right. I would say once people get into the sweet spot of the learning curve, be willing to push them a little bit, push them a little bit harder and not just be like, oh, they got it figured out, we're good. Like, push them a little bit and say, okay, you figured out what you're doing. What else does God want you to do now that you're kind of aware, now that you know what you're doing? Can you, potentially on your ecclesiastical interviews say, I want you to just check in and see what else maybe he wants you to be doing, or look around and just be aware of what might you do differently. And then the final thing I would say is that when people get to the top of the learning curve, I think you've got two things here. Make sure when it's time to release people, you do release them. You listen to that, that prompting, and also be aware that people are going to get bored 3 to 4 years in. And so you probably don't want to leave people in much longer than that. But I also think that you can utilize people who are from a grander arc perspective, people who are in their 50s or 60s or 70s who've had a lot of experience. I think sometimes we put them out to pasture. We've got men in our ward, they're 70, they've been this whatever, and we kind of give them a nothing calling. Like, give them a calling where their job is to be the buddy for someone up and coming.
Yeah.
And let them challenge and say, your calling is perhaps harder here because you've got to figure out how to, from an informal perspective, help bring so-and-so along. And so I think that we underutilize people who, from a sort of age perspective, are at the higher end of the curve.
Mm, that's a great point. Love that. Well, Whitney, I know we're running short on time here, and obviously Amazon is a great place to go and pick up the book. Any other place that you would...
Well, I would say, just since it's a church thing, we'll say Deseret Book. You can buy it at Deseret Book.
Okay.
Yeah. And so if people want to actually go to my website, whitneyjohnson.com /diagnostic, they can actually take the learning curve and see where they are on their current curve and see how they're doing, whether it's from a church or a work perspective. So that's probably, and then you can email me at wj@whitneyjohnson.com.
Awesome. Sounds like a great activity for a bishopric or presidency meeting to everybody find out where they're at on the S curve, right?
Yeah. And something I should have said, actually, This is a really important point, is that you optimize for innovation with 70% of your people in the sweet spot and 15% of your people at the low end and 15% of your people at the high end. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got, for example, this is part of the reason why it's sometimes good to change your counselors, right? Because you've got all people, but if in any given ward, if all your teachers have all been in there for 4 years or all your teachers are brand new, doesn't work. So you want to constantly looking like, do I have 70% of my people who've been here, 2 to 3 years, 15% who are brand new, 15% who have been here longer, because that's when you're going to optimize for innovation and engagement. And so you're going to be most efficient and effective as a unit.
Yeah. Love that. Well, the last question I have, and I asked you the typical question last time, but obviously, as I've talked with Liz Wiseman, she talks about each book that she writes feels like one of a child of hers, like that she just has gone through so much stress and work, and here it is, and she's presenting it to the world. So as you look back at this, of your experience writing this book and learning this new research and principles, how has that made you a better disciple of Jesus Christ?
That's a really good question. I would say, so I think the way it's made, the initial thought that comes to my mind is It makes me recognize when people are at the top of a learning curve that are in my sphere, that sometimes I want them to stay there because, you know, you want people to stay at the top of a learning curve because they do you a lot of good there, right? Because they're really good at what they do. Yeah. And so I think one of the ways it's been helpful to me is realize that people who are within my sphere of influence, whether they're working for me or their family or whatever, is that when they get to that top of the curve, I need to be respectful and helpful to them in giving them the opportunity to do something new and not want them to stay there just because it makes me my life easier. And so I think that our willingness to allow people to grow and develop and go on and try new things, that's made a difference for me.
That concludes my interview with Whitney Johnson. What a fantastic conversation. I always enjoy the conversations with Whitney, and this is another episode that maybe you need to listen to twice or three times and just absorb, let it wash over you and absorb what you can about how to enhance ourselves as leaders through this concept of understanding the S-curves in our quorums, in ourselves personally. How are the S-curves doing and how can we leverage that information to really see people repeat over and over again those S-curves? As she mentioned, go check out her book on Amazon or Deseret Book, wherever it is your favorite place to buy books. It's out there and it's definitely on top of some of those charts because it's very popular and well worth the read. One of my favorite thinkers in the leadership world. So definitely check her out. And don't forget, visit leadinglds.org/teach to check out the three most viewed sessions from the recent Teaching Saints Virtual Summit. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.